Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Tristan Scott. Tristan is an electrical engineer, electromagnetic field expert, speaker, author, and safe technology advocate. He is extremely knowledgeable about the biological effects of man-made EMF and how the communications industry and public health agencies fail to adequately address this pervasive issue. Based in Wyoming, Tristan's approach to health has been born out of ideas of nature being the guide and sovereignty. He is an integral part of Daylight Computer Company, who have developed a new screen technology void of flicker and circadian disrupting light. Daylight are the first tech company to place user health at the very forefront of their mission. Tristan recognizes the unmatched need for education about electromagnetism in health and technologies that are not inherently dangerous to use. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share deep dives into topics like this. It's the best way to support me and the podcast while also getting my in-depth thoughts about these podcast topics. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Tristan, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I've really been looking forward to this, especially since we hung out a little bit in Aubrey a couple of months ago. It's been really great getting to hear your ideas. It really seems like you and I are sort of coming to the same sort of conclusions, sort of independently, just by thinking logically, not really even using, you know, science. It's more just logic than anything else. So it'll be a great time to just get a bit of your insight, particularly into EMFs, which you're a lot more learned about than me.
Yeah, it's exciting to chat. Thanks for having me. It's not very often I get to go deep, or, you know, there's other folks that are kind of like at our level of, you know, nerding out on this kind of stuff. So doing a ton of podcasts is cool, but it's fun to kind of dive deep and reach a point where the science ends, or we just don't know, or there's a big gap. And obviously, the more you learn, the more you realize how prevalent that is. And that's why it's special to kind of like be on this journey together. And we're both like super young. So it's just sort of really exciting, you know, that we're at the frontier of kind of a lot of these fields and potentially can have an impact on driving the science in the right direction, back in the right direction, I should say.
It makes me super optimistic how many young people are really starting to just put all of this together. No science backgrounds. The great thing about understanding this is you don't need a science background to understand the logic of how nature works. And, you know, it's interesting. It's been very difficult for me to find people to have on the podcast who are willing to talk about EMFs. It's very, very difficult to get people on who are willing to, you know, go into what some of the research says and why it's so difficult to do research in this area in the first place. So maybe we could get a bit of your backstory and how you got into this. Most people, it's sort of a crisis of health. I know it was for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very true regarding EMFs. But for me, I studied electrical engineering in university. So I got my bachelor's and master's degree, did, you know, countless hours of calculus and all of the math behind it. But during that time, I wasn't like super passionate about electrical engineering or anything. It was really just for the job. And, you know, it was a good starting point for a career. And it's funny because now I'm at a point where I'm really excited, of course, about electromagnetism and how I can use that background. But it wasn't until late 2018, I suffered one too many concussions. And I really, like, my health just spiraled out of control. And I had to go down, you know, the path of, do I accept this as a new normal, or do I realize that there is a whole, you know, space out there for education and knowledge, which I wasn't aware of, but I stumbled upon, and then I could take this healing journey into my own hands. Late 2017, and then 2018 was really the year that, you know, I went from being a college athlete, engineering student, like, you know, just doing things constantly, very physically active, mentally active, to I needed to sleep 12 hours a night and I could not exercise anymore. Post-concussive syndrome for 12 to 15 months. And yeah, I was fed up with that. You know, I was depressed, anxious, had all the classic symptoms. And eventually, you know, I finished the one semester in school. And then summer of 2018, I was in an internship out in Oregon, where camping, like getting out in nature is what everyone does in their free time. And my roommate kind of pushed me back into that. And I just started feeling better. I didn't know why, but when I was out in nature on the weekends and not at the office staring at a screen all day, like my symptoms resided a bit. I could do more. Like I could go on a hike and not have this like 2-3 day recovery necessary. So that gave me some momentum, started meditating, which put me in a better mind space. And then I just started researching. I didn't know where to start. I started Googling things on, you know, brain recovery and chronic pain and TBIs and concussions. And eventually, you know, I found some books, self-healing books on, you know, people's journeys that were way worse than mine, like people that were paralyzed, you know, years, decades of chronic pain. And it just gave me motivation. And I'm a pretty motivated individual, but having that taken away from you and then, you know, given a ray of hope, you're like, okay, if I can just get 10, 20% better, I'm in a world, a different world completely and in a much better place. So I'm going to do that. And then you do that, you get 10 to 20% better. And then you have all this momentum all of a sudden, like once you break free out of that kind of low point. And yeah, it was right when, you know, people like Joe Rogan were talking a lot about health, and you had people like Ben Greenfield on the show. This whole biohacking space was exploding in terms of, you know, becoming out there for the everyday person to just listen to. So I started experimenting with a lot of things. I actually enrolled in a study. I was part of a study for TBI recovery where we put this kind of like pulsed current device on our tongue to stimulate brain activity while you're doing rehab. That was really cool. It's kind of like stim for your muscles, but you put it on your tongue and that helps, you know, getting my lifestyle habits, sleep, stress, some supplements, like took fish oil, which now I know the DHA component, how important that is for brain health. There's a lot of things I did. And then from there, I kind of just became hooked. And I really just became obsessed with learning about health optimization. And it's just been a 5-6 year journey since then. But what's interesting is that, you know, I had this electrical engineering background, and right then and there in that first year of kind of biohacking, I bought blue light blocking glasses. They were like maybe the not so great ones that were mostly clear, a little yellow. And I started grounding. I had a grounding mat my mom bought me in 2019, but I didn't really take a super deep dive because I kind of became enamored with the food system and regenerative agriculture. And then COVID happened, and that was, you know, I was primed to take a stance on, you know, what's going on with the medical system and healthcare system based on my own recovery journey. And it was just kind of a cool learning experience. But yeah, dove down the food system and regenerative ag rabbit hole for a couple of years, wrote a book in that space, and then finished that up. And I realized, you know, the more I learned, the more it was kind of becoming apparent to me that this electromagnetic, quantum, whatever you want to call it, aspect of biology is really like the lowest level, the deepest you can go. And that's how you would, you know, want to understand and explain the root cause of everything that's going on. And that inherently, this is how nature, this is how all life on our planet is driven. And anecdotally, as the years went by, you know, in 2021, I probably got back to like baseline of where I was pre-brain injury. And then since then, every year, I've just gotten better. I feel better. I have more energy. I'm able to accomplish more things physically, mentally. And it all correlated with the more time I spent outside directly connected to nature, the better I felt. And I wanted to understand why that was the case. And I saw this huge gap, right? Like electromagnetism, these topics, very complicated. Like you need to have a baseline understanding of physics, which is not a required course in high school in America, for example. It's optional. You know, I took it, I took two levels of physics in high school, and then pretty much electrical engineering is all physics and calculus. So I had this understanding, this baseline, even though my career, I went right into like the business side of engineering in the semiconductor industry. I still just had that familiarity and that baseline, even with all the brain injuries. But I was now like, okay, I can relearn a lot of this, but from a biology lens, from a lens where I'm applying it to my everyday. And then when you're passionate about something, you're just much more eager to learn. It's going to resonate stronger. But it was all tying back to that same theme. The more time we spend outdoors connected to what I say now is the real world, the better we feel. Now, why is that? And there's so many rabbit holes to dive down there. And it's all electromagnetic, right? So I said in my presentation, the light, the EMFs, everything. So for me, this is just like a dream come true that my degree I slaved away for is actually very pertinent to what I'm most passionate about now.
It's funny. I think it was Ole Johansson said, you know, the electromagnetic environment has changed. You know, I think it's 10 with 18 zeros behind it, you know, in the last century. And my mantra has sort of been, if we want to understand the chronic disease epidemic, we have to first start with the largest change in our environment in the last century. And to me, it's inescapable to think that that has to be the starting place. You know, just from a logical perspective, you have to start where the largest changes are. And it's, you know, it's a very inconvenient truth. I don't think any reasonable person would say that that's not the largest change in the environment. I think that opposition to that idea is that just because there's more non-native or man-made electromagnetic fields, that's not necessarily a bad thing, which I'm sure we'll get into very soon. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned physics. I think it's good to sort of get terms very clear. One thing that I've noticed a lot lately is that the language that's used and the nomenclature is actually really important in how people understand it. And I want you to sort of help me understand the difference between wavelength and frequency. I know that they're used for different ideas. So we usually use frequency in terms of like Wi-Fi and telecommunications, and we use wavelength more for the light spectrum that we talk about. But I want to get a deeper understanding so that I know how to use those correctly.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, again, the baseline where just having some background, understanding what voltage and amps and frequency and wavelength and energy, because these things get thrown around. And then it is the common, you know, I guess, argument against a lot of what we're saying is the energy or the power is too low and et cetera, which we'll get into. But yeah, I think the baseline where I always start is the electromagnetic spectrum, right? So this is a vast spectrum of electromagnetic waves. And, you know, the source is the sun, right? It's powering all the life in our universe. And this electromagnetic spectrum is very vast. And each wave is comprised, well, you know, it's photonic in nature. So there's photons that are acting as waves and can also act as a particle if you want to go down the wave particle duality, you know, quantum rabbit hole there, that's important. But just keeping a high level, you know, we're talking about waves, and people can conceptualize waves, sound waves, ocean waves, and frequency and wavelength are the two most important characteristics of these waves. And they're inversely proportional directly. So the wavelength is just the measurement of distance for that wave from like trough to trough, or, you know, the bottom to bottom, the one distance it's, you know, measuring to complete a full wavelength. And that can vary tremendously across the spectrum. We're talking about electrical power, 60 hertz, 50 hertz, which is a frequency. These wavelengths are kilometers long, I believe. I could be off by magnitude. But then in the light spectrum, where we have visible light, we're talking in the nanometers range, which is 10 to the minus ninth, which is also, you start throwing around micro and nanometer and gigahertz and megahertz. Like for me, you know, I got assaulted with all of these prefixes for my whole undergrad and grad career. So they're all synonymous in my head to a million or a trillion or a thousand. So I'll do my best to also outline that aspect of it, because that's very important. So the wavelength, again, is the distance measuring the peak-to-peak length of a wave to be completed. The frequency, which is inversely proportional to that, is the number of oscillations that are happening in an electromagnetic wave, or any wave for that matter, in 1 second. So that's measured in hertz and denominated by how many waves are happening in 1 second. So 60 hertz or 50 hertz for the international crowd means that there's 50 cycles of that wave happening per 1 second. And the distance of each wave might be very, very long because it's a low frequency wave. And then we get up the visible spectrum of light, which is the example that other people are very familiar with, and that's completely switched in terms of the frequency is very, very high. It's trillions, hundreds of trillions of cycles per second. And then the wavelength is very, very short. It's nanometers. And that's very important because when we get into things like resonance and how the spectrum is very vast, that all plays into the part of how it can potentially affect our biology. But the last piece there that's important is energy. Energy is directly correlated with frequency in terms of the higher frequency of the electromagnetic wave, the higher energy of that wave of that photon. So those two are directly proportional in terms of how intense or how it's increasing and decreasing. And then the wavelength is inversely correlated to that. So that's kind of the baseline. But I think, again, laying out the electromagnetic spectrum is everything that we can see, but it's mostly what we can't see. So we're talking about everything is light. Power coming out of your outlet, the radio frequencies, you know, airport communication towers, FM, AM radios, microwaves, X-rays, which is getting into ionizing radiation. And then we have infrared, the visible spectrum, ultraviolet. This is all part of what comprises the electromagnetic spectrum. And that all has an effect on our biology. So that's kind of the summary I always start with.
That's really good. I remember speaking with Michael Hamblin before I had a really good grasp on all of this stuff. And I kept saying frequency and he kept correcting me. So ever since then, I've been really scarred and I'm very careful with my terms because I don't want to make that mistake in front of an expert again. But yeah, it's really important, the nomenclature, because yeah, it's the perfect way for someone to say, you know, you don't know what you're talking about because you got the term wrong. And one of the things that sort of gets tossed around is the idea that these frequencies that are used for telecommunications are very low energy because the wavelength is so long. And basically, because they're so long, they're not ionizing. They don't have the capacity to cause any damage. When we get to ionizing radiation, when you can actually, you know, knock out an electron from a chemical substance in the body, like DNA, for example, which is why UV light can have those effects. You know, as soon as you get past that ionizing part, it must be safe. And this, to me, seems like such an anemic way to look at things because, I mean, clearly we know, we'll probably get into the blue light story later, but, you know, blue light's not ionizing at all, but it has significant biological effects. So, you know, this idea that, you know, wavelengths that are not ionizing can't impact our biology is ridiculous on the face. And I guess that's sort of the straw man argument against, you know, these telecommunications frequencies being, you know, potentially dangerous to human health or to the health of wildlife as well. So how do you start to pass that out? How do you start to talk to people about, well, it's not just about whether it's ionizing or non-ionizing?
Yeah, that and the other argument is that the sun is stronger than everything else that we're exposed to technology-wise, which from an energy perspective is of course true. But you know, starting, I don't start here, but it's obvious that, you know, our biology has been designed to take the sun and the spectrum of the sunlight that's reaching the surface of the earth from UV to infrared and visible in between. That's what we're designed for. So where I start with this is typically a few things. You know, you can easily point to someone like Dr. Henry Lai, who has 2,500 plus studies on radio frequencies, power frequencies affecting biology, and 80 to 90% of the studies show harmful biological effects. And the effects range from oxidative stress, which is the most common, to neuropsychiatric issues, to reproductive and fertility issues is a very common one, cardiovascular. And then there's even ones on the genetic level, having genetic damage. And this is all like studies from the 90s to today. There's even more that go back decades. You know, it's funny because this is not like a new argument. This has been ongoing since the 60s and 70s and 80s. You get into, you know, Robert O. Becker and Marino and a lot of these other guys and a lot of folks in the Soviet Union kind of pioneering this research, saying that back then it was mostly power frequencies and kind of the low end of the radio frequency spectrum, because that's all they had back then, having massive impact biologically. And it was high level then, you know, having, you know, blood markers be affected or cancer rates or just oxidative stress. They didn't really get super deep because that was the time. And, you know, people may just dismiss that, saying, oh, those studies are no good. You know, they haven't done interventional studies. It's correlative, or it's from Russia, so it doesn't count. And again, it gets back to your point you made earlier. It is kind of hard to study some of, you know, this material that needs to be done in humans or needs to be done in an actual cell. It can't be just high level correlative, but there's so many confounding factors. Talk about, you know, having a clean control to study for and a clean electromagnetic environment is basically impossible. And then that's a funny argument you can make for basically any study in the entire world, whether it's done on food or just like, you know, cardiovascular outcomes or any interventional study. Are they controlling for the electromagnetic environment? Probably not. But, you know, where I like to start is that we don't need to be in this ionizing radiation category, right? Like you said, we actually have biological systems that are designed or have effect from non-ionizing radiation. And there's clear data out there. And I kind of break it down into like these different categories, because for me, that's the fun part, is like, actually, how is this affecting our biology? But just to, you know, keep it at a high level for folks maybe that don't really understand the depths of biology or kind of electromagnetism, it's that, you know, there's an overwhelming amount of studies. You know, there's weak magnetic fields correlated with childhood leukemia. And more important, there's manufacturing warning labels on our technology. If you go to a cell tower area, they usually have a fence around it saying, you know, highly, you know, strong radiation, like do not enter unless you're certified personnel. Like this is a high radiation area. And they have all these warning signs, right? So if energy of the wavelength was the only thing that mattered, why would they have the warning signs when they're the ones being the source of this non-native electromagnetic radiation? It's way higher power, yeah, but that's power, right? People are arguing only about energy, non-ionizing radiation. So that's where the terminology is really important. And if you want to talk about power, like transmission lines, cell towers, even if the cell phone's held directly next to your brain, that power output is very high, because the number one most important thing to learn about electromagnetic waves is inverse square law, that the distance matters more than anything in terms of proximity to the source, because the second you put an X term of distance from you to the source, you're X squaring the reduction in the field. And that's where it doesn't add up. And that's what everyone says to me, right? Online, well, I'm an electrical engineer too, or I'm a, you know, electrician, or I'm a scientific researcher, a physicist. Like, non-ionizing radiation doesn't have any effect. Well, here's a body of research. Here's an iPhone manufacturing warning label. Here's a picture of a sign outside a cell tower or a high voltage transmission line. Like, yeah, they can be dangerous because of just electrical current, but those signs are there for the field effect, not the direct potential for you to get shocked, which, you know, you could kill yourself with, you know, less than the current needed to charge your iPhone if you didn't realize that. So that's kind of where I start. And it's hard, you know, I don't try to get into arguments with people online. I try and let the science do the talking, or like my posts do the talking, because you're never going to convince someone that doesn't want to be convinced.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bring up the leukemia association. This is something that is very real. I think it's been reproduced in, last time I checked, I think it was 6 different populations across the world, where proximity, I think it was within a kilometer of high voltage power lines and or cell towers, childhood leukemia rates are significantly higher in the closer you get to those. And, you know, thinking about what blood is, you know, it's a very complex sort of filled with iron, filled with these, you know, magnetic substances, you know, oxygen's paramagnetic as well, which is where it's stored in hemoglobin. And you start to wonder, well, it kind of makes sense that if you're putting these, you know, even if they're subtle, you know, the subtlety of the wave doesn't, of the influence doesn't really correlate to the outcome. And this is something that Marino stressed a lot in his work, was that it's not a linear relationship with like higher exposure, higher energy exposure, or higher power exposure means worse outcome. It's not like that at all. And sometimes the more subtle the energy, the worse the results. And I remember him talking about being in court, because he was also a lawyer, and they were cross-examining him and some of the rodent studies that he'd done. And basically, one generation of mice were large, they were oversized, and then the next one was small, and they averaged it out so that it was normal. And he said, "That's, you can't do that. That's not how it works." But unfortunately, that is not able to be communicated sufficiently to the public, that this is how they see it in a court of law. And yeah, I think it's just really important to understand that the effects are nonlinear. It's not the more you put in, the worse the results get. Sometimes you can get really devastating results from really, really subtle exposures. And, you know, this is something that's really hard to communicate to a lay person, this idea of nonlinearity and, you know, the fact that the human body is exquisitely designed to pick up on tiny, tiny signals. And like, this is, again, it goes back to the Soviet Union. They did a lot of this work. And again, you mentioned that they didn't take that seriously. And I think they predominantly didn't take the Soviet research seriously because their scientific method was slightly different to what was being done in the West. So they just wrote it off completely, which I think was a huge mistake, because they were showing, you know, tiny exposures with biological effects way back then. And yeah, you're right. It is quite a large body of evidence. And I think even in 2013, Martin Paul showed unequivocally that one of the ways that it was initiating biological effects is through the partitioning of calcium and magnesium in the cell, calcium efflux. You know, this is not questionable anymore. I haven't seen anyone rebut his work, and it's been out for over 10 years now. So the evidence is out there, but it's very difficult to sort of elaborate in that way.
Yeah, Dr. Martin Powell is a legend. I mean, it's just understanding as well. And the argument I make alongside this is that we're electromagnetic beings. All life on this planet is. We use EEGs to measure our brain activity. We use EKGs to measure our heart activity. Those are electrical devices. And then we use a magnetic resonance imaging machine to find tumors and, you know, torn ACLs, right? So that is magnetic. And, you know, but people will say, oh, well, those have no effect. Well, you're just making like a huge assumption that the reason why we're able to understand our biology is through electromagnetism. Of course, there's a greater picture here of the environment and this vast spectrum that we outlined, how it can affect our biology. But if anyone knows anything about electrical engineering or electromagnetism, is that every frequency, every harmonic, every power level can have different effects. Like these are all knobs to turn, you know, power, frequency, energy, and different harmonics and resonance. And of course, that's going to affect our biology differently. And that's why you see all these mixed results. You know, the polarity matters, the angle. How about the angle of the field? A lot of these interactions depend on perpendicularity between, you know, different fields with each other. And that's something that we're already talking about 6-7 different variables and complexity that's over almost everyone's head. So that's why this all gets lost. It's very inconvenient. And then they don't teach physics at a high level, or I don't think at all, to anyone who's going the traditional medical schooling route. So why would they know? It's not their fault. They're not taught any of this, even though they're using these instruments to measure the health or the state of disease in their patients. So it's fascinating. And yeah, the voltage gated ion channel activation, that's a big one. That's probably like the most popular one. But now we have what, this radical pair mechanism with weak magnetic fields, thanks to just people being curious about how birds circumnavigate the earth. So it's kind of funny that it's like we only get really good research when it has like this side story to it. It's like, oh, I want to research weak magnetic fields because I'm curious how they affect human disease. No funding. Okay, I want to study birds, how they like travel around the world. All right, here's like $5 million. So that's where I think we almost need to appreciate just like how science is structured right now and hope that we can keep finding these parallel benefits or curiosities that will give us the data we need to better understand how biology is functioning at this, you know, subatomic particle level.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. The idea that these exposures in different people, because we're all unique in our own way and we all have different environments throughout our lives, it doesn't just cause one thing. I think that's really the problem, and why we, who knows if we'll ever really get on top of this EMF issue, but it causes just a generalized disturbance to the homeostasis of the system, and what that manifests in is anyone's guess. And I think that's why it's going to be so hard to pull out who's the most exposed and what do they get. It's going to be so scrambled. You won't get, you know, smoking causes lung cancer. You'll get EMF can cause everything, just depending on what else is going on. And it's going to be really almost impossible to untangle that just because we don't really understand how it's differing between different people and different exposures. But yeah, I mean, talking about the magnetism and you know, people trying to figure out how the European robin migrates, like if you look at that, some researchers have tracked the migration lines of these birds, and it's amazing. I can't remember which bird it was, but it's like following a perfect longitude. It's so obvious that they're following a magnetic field. And you know how they're doing that is, you know, the best guess at the moment is this radical pair mechanism. But who knows if other stuff is going on as well. And I think that's something that I've been thinking about quite a bit moving from Sydney to Stockholm, is that the magnetic field here is noticeably stronger. And, you know, at the poles, it's like 90 microtesla, and at the equator, it's like 30 microtesla, I believe. So, you know, being closer to the equator, the magnetic field is much stronger. And I was wondering what your thoughts are
on how these magnetic field gradients impact health, because there's clearly something going on where you have less photon energy further away from the equator. It almost seems like it must be compensated by an increased magnetic field. There must be some sort of mechanism there. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I've been thinking about this a lot. And what's cool is potentially where it also may be even higher in, like, you know, just geomagnetically active areas, like volcanic areas as well. But yeah, that's, you know, that's the trade-off, right? And then at the equator, we have stronger electric fields because there's more lightning from thunderstorms, and grounding would be a stronger effect, right? But yeah, on the magnetism specifically, so resonance is a really important concept here. And again, there's many different ways that, you know, weak or let's say non-ionizing radiation can affect our biology. And molecular resonance is a big one. And that's how magnetic resonance imaging works. So they put you in, let's say, a 1 Tesla, it can be up to 3 Tesla magnetic field. And that is, the Tesla is the unit of measurement for the magnetic field. Actually, it's a measure of magnetic flux density. Another common unit there is Gauss or milligauss. They're the same thing, so just different magnitudes. So 1 Tesla field is like very strong. And that in that field, they then can back calculate that a hydrogen nucleus has a resonance frequency at, I think it's 45 megahertz. Which is a common, it's in the radio frequency spectrum. So they align the hydrogen nuclei, they all align their spins in the same state, and then they pulse a radio frequency at it and they get back a readable image from that, because they absorb the RF and then emit it. And that's important because that's a relationship, right? And what Becker actually wrote about in his other book called Cross Currents is this other notion of why are EMFs affecting our biology? And he was a big proponent that the low frequencies had a much larger effect. Again, he wrote his book way before the advent of modern phones and computers and everything. But he talked about what's called this cyclotron resonance, which some Russian researcher pioneered. And it's that when you have a static magnetic field and then an oscillating electric or magnetic field, just any oscillating EMF perpendicular to that, you can get a lot of important resonance effects on ions and particles, charged particles in our biology, most commonly calcium. Which alludes to, you know, like what we talked about with the voltage gate ion channels, potassium and even lithium. So this field, and they did an experiment, I think it was the Navy, had the static magnetic field at like the level of the Earth. So the Earth's natural magnetic field, like you said, is, I think it's, yeah, 25 to maybe 90, maybe 80 microtesla. I'm sure it varies. Or if you're in Gauss, it's like 0.2 to 0.8 Gauss, let's say. And depending on where you are in the static magnetic field strength, you're going to have a different resonance frequency for each ion particle. It might vary by 10 hertz, 20 hertz. It depends. But calcium at like 50, 60 hertz has a resonance around 0.4 to 0.6 Gauss, or 40 to 60 microtesla, which is right in the range of the Earth's natural geomagnetic field. And what are we exposed to all the time? 50 to 60 hertz, you know, magnetic fields. And the research the Navy did was on lithium, and they found that rats, I think it was even lower, maybe like 0.2 Gauss or 20 microtesla is the static magnetic field. And then they put in a 60 hertz oscillating field. And lithium, if you don't know what lithium like is used for, it's can be used as like a psychiatric medication to make you like more calm and more docile. And it's just kind of like chill you out if you're potentially like schizophrenic or something, or bipolar. And they found that these rats were actually way more passive, a bit more inactive. So if you want to write down a conspiracy theory to research, there you go, is that like maybe they knew this information. But getting back to your question, if you're at the equator and you have like a 20 to 30 microtesla natural geomagnetic field, the resonance of the molecular charged particles that be interacting with other oscillating fields is going to be different. So you're going to have differing interactions with the rest of the EMF environment that you're in. And that can have differing effects. And that is kind of tying in this non-native piece already. And that, you know, technology all around us is also has static magnetic fields that people don't even realize. And I was kind of researching this a little bit too, because it's actually really hard to measure. Like I have an RF meter, I have like a tri-field, but measuring static DC fields is, you need a whole separate device to probably need to buy. But iPhones and Apple Watches, they at like 3 centimeters of distance have a static magnetic field of like 3 to 4 Gauss. So then that would have another, you know, potential impact and potential slew of resonant frequencies that would be affecting our biology. And we'll talk maybe about the radical pair mechanism later, but this is all in that realm of right in the middle of weak magnetic fields affecting our biology via the radical pair mechanism. And, you know, we're around it all the time. So who knows what sort of effect this is having? And all these studies are showing that different frequencies, different angles of interaction, potentially polarities, but then also the strength of the field are all impacting cells and biology differently. And yeah, if you're at the North Pole, you're further up north, you're going to have a baseline difference of the Earth's natural geomagnetic field, but you might be exposed to the same exact non-native man-made frequencies, but that's going to impact you differently. And if we imagine a scenario where there were no man-made EMFs, then yeah, that magnetic flux density that's getting through from the Earth's natural geomagnetic field, that's stronger. But then say you have like a lesser electric field grounding impact, that's an input signal, right? And we know that your mitochondria are constantly looking for these input signals as electromagnetic sensors to adapt to their environment and to understand where they are in the world, what season it is, what time it is. And that's going to affect, you know, the output of the ATP synthase and these paramagnetic oxygen, you know, coming as the final electron acceptor, or of course, the reactive oxygen species, which are so fascinating. And I think the more I read about, the more I realize that what almost everybody thinks about reactive oxygen species is way off, and they're not bad. Actually, they're probably the most important thing going on in terms of cellular signaling. So long-winded answer there. Some cool stuff. Got really excited when I was like, I read that book like, I don't know, a while ago, and now piecing it together with kind of this weak magnetic field research. And it's cool because guess what? Robert O. Becker wrote about this 40 years ago. And we're just now getting more information in the past 5, 10, 15 years. And we're able to think about this and put some dots together. And how is this artificial EMF environment impacting this already dynamic system of gradients, like you call it, and kind of just differing impacts on biology depending where you are in the world?
Yeah, it's such an exciting thing to think that, you know, if you're in Costa Rica versus if you're in Norway, the action of a reactive oxygen species is going to be different because the magnetic field is substantially different. The flux of electrons through the respiratory proteins is going to be different because the magnetic influence upon that is going to be completely different. And it's interesting you bring up the minerals as well, because it's something that I've been grappling with here. You know, there's not many vegetables grow here. You know, the ability to get magnesium and potassium, for instance, you know, really, I mean, what do you get? If you drink the blood of an animal, it's probably your best bet. But, you know, I think there has to be a way that the body is dealing with, you know, the shift in ratio between availability of minerals. And, you know, it makes sense to me now thinking that that's has to be tied into the magnetic field strength that we're talking about now, because you simply can't, you know, you can't provision the same ratio of minerals that you can provision on the equator. It just doesn't make sense to have the same recommendations in different places. It's and clearly there's something going on, because we've had successful populations in all over the world that have been doing things that are against, you know, uniform recommendations. It's, and, you know, it also goes to show, and this really annoys the crap out of me, this idea that we can terraform Mars. It's just ridiculous because it has none of the electromagnetic givens that we have here. And if you understand anything about how we evolved, it's everything is finely tuned to the electromagnetic givens we have here. And the moment you try and set up on Mars, you have no idea how the body is going to respond. And this is something that is a huge problem in spaceflight because they all get sick like instantly. And they don't know why. And I feel like you and I are sitting here going, we know why. You know, it seems very logical that, you know, when you get rid of the primary thing that built what we are, of course, things are going to start going wrong. It's just, yeah, it's just grinds my gears a lot. Yes, this radical pair mechanism, my understanding is that that hasn't been proven in vivo. It's only sort of a something that they've been able to do in the lab. But it seems quite reasonable to me to think that maybe you can explain a little bit about like what it is and how it might be used for magnetoreception.
Yeah, and also just a side comment is, yeah, space travel, I hope they keep studying this stuff. Like, please, so let's go live on Mars so we can study EMFs on Earth more.
Yes. That's yes, exactly.
Yeah, there we go. But yeah, it's so true. I mean, you see the data too. Like these guys go up there and just everything's gone wrong. So yeah, the radical pair mechanism and weak magnetic fields affecting biology again is really fascinating. And it's very complex and it's totally quantum, I guess, in nature. And so is all of magnetism, really, because you think of the definition of spin, right? Like it's this very odd characteristic of subatomic particles. Specifically, here we're talking about electrons. And I heard this and it really made it simple for me. It's like, the mass of an object is how something is going to like act in a gravitational field. The charge of an object dictates how it's going to act in an electric field. And then the spin is going to dictate how it's acting in a magnetic field. So when you frame it like that, it's very kind of digestible that this is just a characteristic that's magnetic at its core. We're using a English word that doesn't really capture the full, you know, essence of what it is because we simply just don't have words to describe what it is. And really it gets down to the core of, you know, some things you mentioned, but that, you know, electrons when they're unpaired. So you mentioned oxygen being paramagnetic. What does that mean? It means it has an unpaired electron, and that is allowing it to interact with magnetic fields in its environment. Because when electrons are paired fully, they cancel each other out. Their magnetic moment cancels each other out. And the radical pairs is kind of like, it's like another level above this. So when radicals are formed, which is typically, from my understanding, through photo excitation, they're basically, you know, exciting an electron to an unpaired state, and it can be in this singlet form or triplet form, and it depends how these pairs are formed as well. They need to be in the right circumstance. They need to have like the right distance between them, and they need to be in the right combination as well. So who's the guy? I think I've written down Jonathan Woodward explained this like brilliantly. I think he's from the University of Tokyo or something. But basically, you need to have all these conditions, right? You need to have radical pairs that are formed. So typically through photo excitation, then they kind of need to like separate, have the right distance between them, reform. And then he goes deep into this singlet triplet state mixing, which is this fascinating phenomenon that when there's two triplet pairs or a singlet, they might not combine as well because like the activation energy is just far too high. It's like they have to climb uphill and it just doesn't really work out. So they need to be in this singlet triplet mixing state in terms of radical pairs. And the fascinating phenomenon is that when you have a weaker magnetic field as opposed to a stronger one, that mixing is actually more efficient. So then you're having more biological effects, and then, you know, you're eventually able to influence chemical reactions as a result of that. So this is something, you know, I've been reading a lot more about recently. It's almost impossible to like explain this verbally on a podcast, but just at a high level is like, you need to have all the right circumstances, and you're forming these radicals that are excited through, typically, I think the most common thing they found is in flavin proteins, which absorbs blue and ultraviolet light. So that excites the electron into a radical state. It's creating a free radical, right? Like everyone's familiar with reactive oxygen species, these free radicals. So that's what's being generated. And then they're having the right distance between them. And then their states, if they're in singlet and triplet form, are mixing. And when they're interacting, then remember they're radicals. So they have a spin, and the singlet and triplet state is kind of describing that type of spin they have. So when they're in a magnetic field in that environment, the weaker magnetic field, less than, I don't remember, 10 millitesla or something, but in the range of the Earth's magnetic field, in the range of kind of, you know, areas where people just dismiss any biological impact, but also in the range of where things like childhood leukemia being correlated as low as 4 milligauss start to make sense. And that's going to have these biological impacts that can influence chemical reactions. Because again, if you look at the pure kinetics of it, you might say that there's no chance something that weak can influence a chemical reaction. Like it's magnitudes of energy levels higher. However, from this radical pair mechanism, they're able to influence these type of reactions. And in the flavin molecule, in the cryptochrome protein, which has been studied as like the core essence of this magnetoreception in now many animals, but more famously the migratory birds such as the European robin or the homing pigeon. I think they even found it in monarch butterflies, which apparently travel from Canada to Mexico every year, which I didn't even know that. I just knew in New Jersey where I grew up, they would like come through all of a sudden and everyone freaked out. So that was pretty cool stuff, like coming full circle. But yeah, it's really interesting because this is purely theoretical, like quantum physics, quantum biology research. But it makes a lot of sense because the Earth's natural geomagnetic field is in that range of weak magnetic field interactions. And now there's all these, you know, research papers that are coming out from folks like Jonathan Woodward, some in Russia. A lot of them are studying it in like planarium, which are these little like worms that are super fascinating. I think Michael Levin does a lot of his research on planarium too, because they're like 30 to 40% stem cells. So they're kind of monitoring how weak magnetic fields are interacting with the planarium. And again, this is kind of separating out. They're assuming the radical pair mechanism is like what's going on, but they're proving that weak magnetic fields are affecting biology. And what all the research is saying is that, you know, a different frequency, a different field intensity, and a different angle drastically influences the outcomes of the stem cell proliferation, the blastema regeneration, and the reactive oxygen species. So it's all tying back to the magnetic field component interacting with these free radicals, which is mostly going to be via this like radical pair mixing mechanism, which is probably way too complicated for anybody to understand, but it's kind of really cool to at least conceptualize. But my takeaway is the fact that all these different, you know, characteristics of an EMF have different outcomes, which is really cool.
Yeah, I think you've summed it up really well there. I like to think of it like there's all these different gradients. With all the different signals that we're getting on Earth, we have gradients of them, and they all have to sort of triangulate in order to make things make sense. And unfortunately, it's almost impossible to triangulate them all really well in the modern world because there's so many man-made signals that are coming in and mixing things up. But yeah, this whole magnetism story is very much in its infancy, and I'm hoping to get some more people to talk to who are really looking into this. I know Bettany Adams is a researcher who's really looking into this, and hoping to have her on as well, because I think this is really quite an important thing to look at, because I think there will be situations where increasing the magnetic field that you're exposed to could be beneficial, but also decreasing it could also be beneficial.
Yeah.
So, you know, finding out where it might be better to, you know, go to a volcanic area where there's a stronger magnetic field for healing, or perhaps even, you know, going somewhere where it's weaker. I think trying to figure out where those circumstances would be could be really helpful for healing. I want to ask you about what it was like meeting Jerry Pollack earlier this year, and what you guys spoke about.
Yeah. Well, I just want to sum up there too. I think to me, the conclusion there is that we know so little about how this is like affecting our biology. So anyone who's selling you like a PEMF mat or something where they know the frequency and the resonance, like, it very well could be true, but like, we are literally just scratching the surface of understanding which frequencies. And then again, if you're using a PEMF mat at one frequency for anyone who buys the product, but you're in Sweden or you're in the US or you're in Australia, you know, you could have a completely different outcome. Why? Yep. Because, you know, you're in a different magnetic field environment. You're in general in a completely different environment. So it is very locally dependent. And then the other thing that the main conclusion, and maybe we could talk more about, is just the fact that reactive oxygen species are literally so important. And if you try and play around with antioxidants on a regular basis, supplementally, or, you know, you're just overindulging them in your diet, you're also affecting kind of the magnetic response and interactions and potentially blunting a lot of these important signals. However, if you know, you hop on an airplane and fly around the world, that may be the time to blunt these signals, because that's an artificial one. And that's kind of what I've been thinking a lot about. And it comes back again to just understanding the locality importance. But yeah, Pollack. Pollack is a legend. He spoke at my conference, visited Wyoming, and that's another area, right? So he doesn't study it explicitly, but we talked about now voltage-gated ion channels. We talked about resonance, and we talked about weak magnetic fields, radical paramagnetism. The other big one that we haven't mentioned here yet is water, right? So biological water and how it can potentially be affected by EMFs. And Gerald Pollack is, you know, famed and very well-deserved in terms of being the world expert in structured water, bringing us fourth phase of water, understanding that water can act as a battery that is fueled by light, specifically infrared light, to the highest degree. And talking to him, seeing him present on this information was amazing. And, you know, I did probe him on EMFs and everything. And he had this study that kind of didn't come to the finish line because a grad student left. I think he probably tells it on every podcast, is that the Wi-Fi was reducing the exclusion zone. What else did I ask him? I asked him what he thought about eating undercooked or raw meat, because it has more water, and water, based on some science, which is controversial, can, you know, retain memory and energy signature of where it came from. So I thought, hey, wouldn't it be advantageous if you're consuming raw meat from like a very high quality source and quality animal? He's like, yeah, that makes total sense, like based on what we know. So he was on board with that, but didn't really probe deep. You know, what I think's missing in the scientific community, and what you have personally like kind of proliferated a little bit, is just more collaboration, right? From these folks studying adjacent fields, as we see here, right? There's gaps. And the only reason why I've ever been invited on a podcast is because I'm like bridging a couple fields and at a very, let's say, above average level. But I'm not an expert in electrical engineering, and I'm not an expert in biology. It just happened to like, if you understand a little bit from each side, then you can actually make some conclusions and put some pieces together, and then just be really motivated to find this breadcrumb trail of what may actually be going on. And that is definitely highlighted, right? It showcases me that most of science and academia is siloed and centralized. And Pollock has really paved the path forward, but because he's kind of treated as an outsider from anyone in this space in academia, and is only celebrated by people like us and people who research water, he really hasn't, you know, been able to, you know, connect a ton of dots since he published his papers. But it's fascinating to think what may be possible if we can just change the entire dynamic of how science is done and sharing more information across disciplines. But yeah, water, we're 60 to 70% water. I mean, depending on how old you are, it could be maybe 50 to 80% if you're including newborns and the very end of stage of life being on the low side of that percentage. And we know from like Emilio Del Giudice's work that water can act in these coherent domains as like an antenna and emit and absorb electromagnetic frequencies and fields. And, you know, they're constantly resonating and oscillating. And, you know, Mei-Wen Ho talked about this, proton water chains. And then we can get into, there is some science that I found that showing EMFs affecting like proton tunneling and hydrogen bonding. So that's like a whole field that nobody wants to research because there's no incentive, because it's like EMFs and water couldn't be less attractive for anyone in academia. But that's clearly a big piece of this puzzle. And even the fact on like how light is interacting with our biology, a lot of it, as Pollock has shown, is due to water. And there's some cool research. I think the guy's name is Andre Sommer, that's showing, you know, the reason why infrared light is speeding up ATP synthase, rotational speed and also output, is because the water, the cytochrome C, and cytochrome C oxidase is almost acting as like a little transistor, a field effect transistor. So there's like these pieces all over the map, but it's clear that water is extremely important in this whole equation. And for me, it's one of the main reasons why we would be impacted by non-native electromagnetic fields, because water is always interacting with electromagnetic fields. It can act as a battery, and it can also act as a capacitor with a very high dielectric constant. And everything in biology is surrounded by water. So,
yeah, it really is sort of the medium through which communications are happening in the body, it seems. It's very interesting to me to think about the mitochondria having this particular type of water that is almost devoid of deuterium, making the quantum effects are going to be much much stronger without the deuterium in it. And then you've got, you know, all of these electric fields being generated by the movement of charge very quickly and very strong, you know, very strong charge gradients across the membranes. You know, what is it, 30 million volts across the inner mitochondrial membrane because of the proton gradient. And, you know, to think about what that's doing to the water inside the mitochondria, it's going to be highly polarized, in my opinion. And if it's really polarized, it's probably going to be extremely beneficial for allowing quantum effects to happen if you've got all of that coherence going on. And it's, you know, again, it's not surprising that a lot of this ties back to water. It's sort of the medium through which everything else happens. It's, yeah, and your idea about raw meat is very interesting to me, because I think it was the second night we got here, we went out to a restaurant. It's like one of the oldest restaurants in Stockholm. And the first thing we had was the beef tartare. And nice. It was unbelievable. It was one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life. And, you know, people who haven't tried fresh, really high quality steak tartare are missing out. It's really quite unbelievable what it does to you when you eat it. And I'm working with a client now who inexplicably, he said, I can't explain it, but I feel so much better just eating my meat raw. He's in Switzerland, so he has access to these beautiful local meat.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, how do you explain that? And yeah, the water content seems to be quite an interesting thing to think about. It's very tasty as well.
In summer as well. It's just like hydrating, right? So it's fitting for summer and high solar yield, it seems like.
Yeah, and I suspect we would have eaten a lot more raw meat in the past as well. The fact that it was like the first thing on this menu from this really old Swedish restaurant, it must have been around for a really long time. So this probably is a good point for me to ask you about the Daylight Computer, which I've been very interested in. The ethos of the company that you're involved in is the thing that I like the most. And I think it's really the first company that actually cares about the health of the people who use the tech. And to me, it's always been a struggle, because you need to use computers. I'm on a computer right now. You need to use them. But to have an option where you can use it and not be stressed about how much it's damaging your eyes and your brain, it's really quite incredible. And to me, it's solved two principal problems. One is that it doesn't flicker, and I'd really love to talk about that. I think that's the most important thing to me, is not having any flicker in the screen. And also, you can use it outside. In fact, it encourages you to be outside. And it's got me outside on more occasions in the last few weeks than I would have been able to if I was just working on a computer. So maybe you can give a bit of a background on what the Daylight Computer, the DC1, is. And then I really want to know more about Flickr, because it's something that's very interesting to me.
Yeah. Daylight Computer, as a company, we are the only company in the world, like, purely at step one, building technology with health and well-being in mind. And, that was why I dropped everything I was doing, jumped on board. And it's just so compelling, because as an electrical engineer, again, the difference between me and maybe some researchers is that I want to go and like find things out. I want to build things. Like, I know that it's possible to build healthier technology. And most people probably don't understand that. But the barrier to entry for me, I always thought was going to be too high. Like, we'd never see this like really fixed at a fundamental level, just because of how centralized and how just monopolistic the technology industry is. But, we've been able to, bring a product to market, and, my founder Anjun invented alongside Japanese researchers a new display technology. And that's really the core essence behind our innovation today. And then we are building out like a whole software ecosystem. But to understand, what we're doing, which your audience kind of understands, is why is technology bad for us? Why are phones and computers bad for our health? The big component is the screen, right? We're being just bathed in artificial light that has a very, alien spectrum. It's high in blue. It's completely absent in infrared. And it's also flickering or pulsing constantly. So the flickering component is that, these LEDs are just not constantly on. They are changing an amplitude of brightness on some devices, can be up to hundreds of times a second. And there's actually, again, like a Goldilocks zone of it being really bad for you, because if you go to such a high frequency, it almost becomes a non-issue and feels like a direct current. Or if you go to a low enough frequency, you'll literally be able to see it. And then, it's also not as bad, because no one would ever make a product like that. But in general, iPhones are far worse than MacBooks, but you can literally look up, what are the effects of flickering LEDs? And the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, which is like, my world, the group of just engineers that work on projects and devices, they have a whole PDF and statement and research saying flickering LEDs causes eye strain, it causes headaches, migraines, it aggravates symptoms of autism in children, and it can even exacerbate anxiety, panic attacks, and epileptic episodes. So right around that 60 to 90 hertz is when we can no longer visually see flicker. So all of these are happening above that. So it's hard because just like EMFs, we can't see it. And although we can't see it, everyone can feel it, right? At the end of the day, your eyes hurt. You have a headache if you just worked on your computer for 10 hours. And digital eye strain and, you know, all these things, they're not even real things. We just like newly invented them as a medical term, digital eye strain or computer vision syndrome. And the statistics are all over the map, but you could argue 50 to 90%. I mean, honestly, anybody who's staring at a screen for more than 1 hour a day probably has some form of eye strain. And then we get into the blue light component, where I just posted something today because the Washington Post was saying, well, there's no science saying like blue light is harmful for eye health, when there's literally a paper that studies like almost a lot of light spectrum's effect on mitochondria in the retinal epithelium cells. And it's obvious from this piece of research that blue light in isolation increases reactive oxygen species and increases mitochondrial dysfunction. And then the infrared, or maybe it was just the red spectrum that they studied, actually didn't reverse, but it had like a net positive effect. And you wonder, you know, again, you get your non-awake, just normie person. Well, there's blue light in the sun. Yeah, but you know, you never get blue without red and infrared. And you've probably done the most amazing podcast on why near infrared light is so beneficial for our health, as Scott and Bob Forsberry. And that's really important because, you know, that's what's missing. And then we get into the radio frequencies and potentially also the static magnetic fields, which is a new discovery, at least data-wise for me. And more importantly, the addictive nature, right? Like, our phones are designed to be addictive. They're designed for us to stay on them longer. They're designed for us to be scrolling on social media and then giving our data to this algorithm so that it feeds back content you want to see, so you end up spending more time on screen. That's a business model for big tech, right? They're making money off of your eyes, off of your attention. We are quite literally in an attention-based economy today. And it's one of the few things that's propping up our fiat monetary system. So there's no incentive for any of these big tech companies to change what they are doing. You know, Apple sells 75 million iPads a year. They have 50% of the market share. Even if they made, like, let's say a slightly better version or a healthier version, what are they going to do? Just say the rest are unhealthy? You know, there's no incentive. And they have this night mode now, right? Or you can turn your phone on night mode to get rid of the blue light or be more warm. They're like half acknowledging that this is a problem. And it doesn't even get rid of, you know, the blue light. And if you turn your phone to grayscale, which is a great way to maybe desensitize or maybe resensitize your dopamine receptors from just being over assaulted by stimulating light and unbelievable content every day. It actually doesn't get rid of the blue light, because grayscale on a normal LCD or OLED screen is just color mixing to get gray. So what we've done at Daylight is we have a new screen technology that is similar to electronic ink. Think of a Kindle. But it solved that issue of electronic paper being too slow in terms of refresh rate to be used for full internet, app, web browsing, video watching functionality. So it's a monochrome screen. You can use it outside because it's reflective at its core. And that's beneficial because obviously outside is where we're designed to be. We have lower non-native EMFs, stronger natural EMFs. We have the sunlight. We have grounding, which is a fully, you know, bioelectrical process as well that's beneficial. And yeah, we're able to get all of the right input signals if we can work outside. And our modern computers are not designed for that. You know, the screen is not bright enough. When you go outside, you can't see your MacBook. It's because that brightness from the LEDs being an emissive screen is directly competing with the sun. So most people don't realize that outdoor environments can be 10,000 times, even maybe 50,000 times more bright than indoors. That's why when you go outside and you're like, oh, I can't even see. That's because that's how vast the change is. And what is brightness? It's a measure basically of photon density, which is energy. And we're leaving all that energy on the table by being indoors and wonder why, you know, we have chronic fatigue and ultimately chronic disease proliferating. So if we have computers that allow us to work outside, they have longer battery life, you can see the screen, and you know, you don't need to worry as much because it has a reflective screen, you can use it properly, then we're able to be both productive but also get the benefits of being outside. And I think the stat everyone throws around is we spend 85-90% of our time as humans indoors now, and to me that's just the most glaring thing, right? Obviously I don't follow that by any means, but again, I'm able to work like in the park on a daylight computer and get work done. And it's really cool. So at a company level, we're just getting started. You know, we are acknowledging all these things are bad for us and, you know, EMFs as well. What can we do? What can I innovate on in our Gen 2 or phone coming down the road in a few years, so that the hardware itself has a lower electromagnetic footprint, it's lower specific absorption rate, SAR readings, which is what they use to test for phones. Like, how do we do that, right? Because once you acknowledge a problem and you have a team, you have the resources to build a solution, and then you have the customer demand that wants that, then you can actually build things that are better for humanity. And it's taken a while to get to this point, but I think the timing is quite perfect because a lot more people are becoming aware of this. They're maybe not aware of any of the science like we are, but they're very aware that technology is addicting, it's bad for them, and it's absolutely ruining the next generation of kids that are just spending all their days glued on screens. So yeah, we launched in May this DC1 first product, and it's a reflective screen, use it outside. And then at nighttime, it has a 100% blue light free backlight. So that's an innovation we did as well, right? Like blue light blockers are, I don't know if I have a pair right here, but blue light blockers are great. Red screen filters like Iris and Efflux are great, but they're band-aids, right? They're not addressing the root cause of the issue, which is the LEDs themselves. So what we did is we made a hardware change to completely get rid of flicker. So we use a direct current modulation of or direct current modality for dimming and brightness changing, whereas 99.9% of electronic circuits that control LEDs for lighting use what's called pulse width modulation control. And then we actually made a custom amber spectrum. So not only do we have zero blue light when you turn it to full amber mode, but it's actually spread out quite nicely from like 520 to, I don't remember, 700 nanometers, probably like 650 actually. And then you get a broader spectrum. It's more spread out. You have lower peak power densities in certain wavelengths. And then you have a little bit of yellow and green, a lot of orange and amber, and some red, so that you can actually see the screen because your eyes are more photosensitive to yellow and green light versus just red. That's why when you have a pure red screen or you're wearing pure red blue light blockers, you literally can't see anything because you're not as photosensitive in your receptors to that wavelength of light. And you would never see a red isolated wavelength in nature. It doesn't exist. You know, what do we have? We have fires. We have candles. Take the spectrometer and take a picture of a fire, and there's a little bit of green, more yellow, more orange, more red, even more infrared. We're working towards that. And I think in the next generation, we will be able to put in some infrared LEDs so that we're even closer to a candle. But even now, we have a nice broad spectrum that you can visually see. And then you don't have to crank the brightness up because it's pure red. It's amber. It's orange. So you can actually see it a little bit better. So it's fun. You know, I feel like I'm just like a kid in like a scientific playground, and then just getting to bring this to the world is such an exciting feeling. And, you know, it's awesome getting people like yourself involved, having a platform to share this message. And I really think, you know, we have that ability to give people an alternative for something that there just isn't one available. And that's inspiring and exciting for me.
all of that is just such music to my ears. And it's just been such a pleasure to use a device that really feels organic. It feels like it's a very passive device, whereas all the other devices that I use are very active. It's like, something about the colors and the way the screen hits your eyes, it's just such a different experience. And, you know, I've had a lot of companies reach out to me to like try and push their supplements and stuff. And I really can't stand that. And that's why there have never been any ads on my podcast, or I've never tried to sell anything to anyone, because I really hate doing it. And really, this is the first company I've come across. And you know, knowing you, it's like, I actually know the people involved and I know what they want to do with this. It's got really nothing to do with money at all. In fact, if you wanted to make money, trying to make a device like this would be the worst way to go about it. It's just really nice to have something that's actually helpful and feels like an extension of myself, rather than something that's trying to zap energy from me. I'm very pleased, and it makes me really optimistic for the future as well, that we can actually have our cake and eat it too, in some sense, you know, with technology, because we do need it and it's very, very helpful and I'm grateful for it. But, you know, it's not that hard to make it, you know, safe to use. And particularly for children, I think this is really where, you know, the main benefit of these things is going to come from, is actually, you know, helping kids stay away from the devices, but still be able to use them in a safe manner. And hopefully, I think if you can get a daylight phone, that would be probably the even better. All of it's just music to my ears, and it makes me really optimistic for the future that people are taking these problems seriously. And not only are they taking them seriously, now we actually have solutions that don't hamper the way that we work, that allow us to just continue doing what we're doing, but in a safe way. I'm really excited to see you know, what you guys are up to next. So what have you been working on? Like, what's next for you and Daylight?
Yeah, well, right now we're just working on getting our first orders out the door. So we launched in May, we sold out, did have some lead time. So those first units will be shipping end of October, November, December. So that'll be really exciting to get into people's hands and just get the word out there. We're constantly iterating on our software. So again, we're building our whole own operating system to center around, you know, productivity, low distraction, and kind of just well-being in terms of tech. Ultimately, like I alluded to, we want to, you know, make a Gen 2, and we eventually want to do a phone as well. So once we sell enough of the Gen 1 and things are rolling in the right direction, we'll have that ability. But really, you know, for me, it's a grassroots movement that we're starting. So I've been doing a lot of podcasts, been seeding a lot of products to people who can move the needle and also just understand what we're trying to do and want to be a part of it and are very mission aligned. So I see it as just a community-based effort to spread the word. And then once we get to a certain point, we can do so much. We can do a phone. I mean, we could start, you know, doing our own research. I'm working to put together a pilot study now for iStrain. If there's any sleep researchers listening to this or anyone who wants to get involved, don't hesitate to reach out. We're always looking for partnerships and opportunities to explore. So yeah, just anything you can imagine is going on.
Yeah, I can't imagine how busy you must be with all of this, just trying to get it off the ground. But again, I'm super grateful that this kind of stuff is being done, because, you know, I feel like a lot of what I do is just talk, but this is actually just you guys have gone out and done something that can have quite a drastic impact on the health of the next generation. Just super grateful, glad to be you know, sort of a part of it as well. I feel very privileged and grateful to even have the chance to use one be on the cutting edge of this new tech that I hope really takes hold. Because, you know, for everything we've spoken about over the last hour and a half, this is really sort of moving forward and getting away from the issues. So again, just super, super glad that to be on board and to be involved, and grateful for what you guys are doing.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's platforms like this, it's podcasts, it's kind of decentralized education, if you want to call it that. It's the willingness of people to listen and learn to folks that they trust out there is the only reason why this is possible, right? You know, as much as we hate social media sometimes, we launched our product, like 95% of our sales came from like Twitter and organic, just like community-based feedback. And that's the benefit of these platforms and of the ability to, you know, be an independent researcher and put this information out there. However, there is a, you know, two-edged blade to all of these things that we're using. So what if we could make that, you know, a non-invasive experience? And that's what's most exciting. Again, coming back to everything we've talked about, the EMF story, like we dove deep into EMFs. And that's just like one angle here with Daylight that we could potentially improve. And then it's also, again, pushing something in the right direction. Maybe we do have enough momentum in 3 to 5 years to fund this stuff ourselves, or to, you know, someone listening to this podcast is in university and they want to go do a PhD program or something. It all adds up. And the one thing I can tell you is that there's no conversation, there's no piece of information or relationship or time spent that's invaluable because you know, I've traveled the world, done a bunch of conferences now, and every interaction with someone talking about, you know, our mission or talking about electromagnetic aspects of our biology, it's very powerful. And the more we do that, and the more people we have doing that, the more impact and change we can drive. And we can really build a, you know, a future that is not only, you know, innovative and kind of groundbreaking from a technology perspective, but it can be in line with our biology, and then potentially even augment our biology if we understand it, or heal ourselves from things that we did in the past that were damaging, like we're talking about. What if we did, you know, spend $50 million on understanding magnetic fields effect at certain frequencies and certain locations for certain medical conditions? I sure bet that they can, you know, affect our biology positively. I mean, Robert O. Becker, you know, used to I don't know the verb, like put rats and mice under anesthesia with magnets. Basically, it would paralyze them and knock them out with just magnets. You could do that to humans, and we don't have to pump people full of drugs. We just need to study it and think that it's worthwhile. But that's the direction I think we can trend towards. And yeah, talk with a lot of people in this space. Fixing indoor lighting, fixing screens will be massive. And then we're on to, you know, the structure, infrastructure behind wireless technology, I think would be the next big one. And we're already making headway by just thinking about it and talking about it.
What a beautiful sentiment to end with. I couldn't have put it better myself. I think, like you said, conversations like these are really, they have quite a big effect. Even though it doesn't seem like it would, but the butterfly effect of stuff like this is really, really large. So yeah, thanks for the chat, man. I really appreciate giving me some of your time. I learned a lot.
Absolutely, Cam, it's always a pleasure. And yeah, look forward to whenever we could connect again in the future in person. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. I've left all of the links to Tristan's social media accounts, YouTube channel, and to the Daylight Computer Company in the episode notes. Please feel free to subscribe to the podcast, as it really helps me grow the channel and get more incredible guests to speak with. As I previously mentioned, I also have a Substack that I go into even more detail about these podcast topics and offer my thoughts and ideas. This is the best way to keep on track with my work while also supporting the podcast. I've left all the links for that below, as well as my social media accounts. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.